Hi, everybody. I'm Diana. I'm an alcoholic. Excuse me. I always get a little cotton mouth. Oh, well. It's not like you've seen me not drink before. That's good. Anyway, it's really good to be here and to be sober. I would like to thank Damien for asking me to speak. I really appreciate it. A lot of that appreciation just comes from my gratitude, you know, for sobriety. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. It's given me a totally just a free pass on life, you know, based on where I was going when I got here. You know, and I have to say, you know, it's nice to see a full room, and it's Christmas time, and, you know, hopefully your 10-step list is shorter than it was last year, you know. I know it can get crazy, you know, all the expectations and all the things. I know in my early sobriety I thought a lot about, you know, what I wanted to be different, you know, and how to make it up with my family and how to be around them when I'm not drinking and all that stuff. Yeah, it's really good. I have to say, this afternoon I looked at my phone and I had a text from my brother, and he was asking me for some money. And the story about that is, you know, he's one of us, and I'm a little sad about, you know, I don't know if he's going to make it here or not, you know. He's one of us, and what I've learned in this program and a program, sister program of Al-Anon is, you know, he might make it and he might not, you know, and it's alcoholism is cunning, baffling, and powerful. And the last time I saw him in Thanksgiving, you know, his liver, it just felt like I could touch it and it would pop, you know. And, you know, all the years I've been sober, I have not carried the message to my brother. It's just right away it was taught to me to just be an example, be a presence in his life, because I love him so much that I have a blind spot. I can't see, I can't help him in the way that I could help another alcoholic. But that alcoholic, I just can't touch. And it's been tough. It's just been tough, you know. I don't give him money, that's for sure. But I did reach out and call some other alcoholics, you know, who are ready and waiting, should he ever want to reach out for help. And, you know, I had to pray. I haven't called him back, you know, because right away I just have that desperation sometimes in my heart. And why sometimes I do think about, you know, I'm here, I'm sober. I've been sober by God's grace in this program for a little over 31 years. And my life is full and it's happy. And it's ups and downs, sure, but it's happy and I'm free, you know. And I know he's having a hard time, you know. He's a bartender for 20 years, and he lost his job. And it's hard to look for a job when you've got to maintain, you know. It's hard. And he's going to lose his place and all the things that happen to us, you know, when we're powerless. Because when you have to drink, you have to drink. And I just hope he makes it. And the thing that I was taught to do is to turn it over and reach out to other alcoholics. And I did that. And it's like, okay, God, oh, I turned it over, and I thought I'd do the next right indicated thing, which is I thought, well, I don't need to stay at home and wait for his call, so I got in the car and decided to come here early, and I thought, well, I'm taking the steps again, and so my sponsor suggested I do a little writing about what do you want in a higher power, and what do you not want? And I thought I would do that here, but my headlight went out. So I went over to Riley's and got the bulb and made sure I got some bulb grease so it wouldn't short out. And it was too dark, and I just couldn't get that goddamn thing in. It was one of those things that became a mission, you know. And anyway, and I did that before the meeting. So I don't know, you know, how that will help me turn it over with my brother, but in some way I know it does. It just keeps me into today. You know, with my brother and I, we're very different people growing up. I loved life, like artistic and goofy. I felt like kind of a baby giraffe, just kind of all over the place. And my brother was always kind of slow and steady. And But the thing we have in common is the way alcohol makes us feel. And I know he's not drinking tonight because he's wrong or he's bad. You know, he's like me. You know, he had that effect with alcohol. And I love the feeling that I got when I drank. And I got it really young. I drank really young, and I couldn't wait for my parents to leave the house. Somehow, I just knew that, for me, it was just that sense of comfort. It was an answer. Growing up, we had a pretty normal, I would say the typical normal military family. My dad was in the Coast Guard, and we lived on a lot of beaches. Particularly, my favorite area to live was Guam. It's an island way out there, and I loved it out there. I love the peace and just the beauty of it. And I think when I came on stateside, I felt like I never could quite catch up and fit in with everybody. It just seemed to be a few steps ahead. And I always felt a little different, and I thought it was because of that. And, you know, just tried to make the best of it. And growing up in a home like that, it's, you know, both my parents were very young, and they tried to do the best that they could. They both left home and never looked back. My dad's from central Louisiana, and my mom is from Canada. And they both ended up on this in Puerto Rico, which is another island, I guess seeking adventure, you know? And they found it in a bar. And 9 months later, they had me. You know, and the thing is, I don't know. They both were moving out of the house for different reasons. You know, my mom, I think, had nowhere else to go and left Canada, and my dad just needed to get the hell out of the South. You know what I'm saying? And so when we grew up, you know, they both had this sense. There was always this air of austerity, you know. I mean, we just lived on just a super tight budget, and everything was clean and organized and just kind of like the sick bay that my dad ran, you know. And then once in a while during the holidays, we'd have these just a glut of gifts and presents, you know. And I know growing up, they wanted to give us everything that they didn't have growing up. And, you know, my perception, my brother, I think, was probably like, hey, this is great. But, you know, growing up, my perception of that was, you know, I felt always a lot of pressure, you know. I always felt like the spring inside of me was, I always wanted to make sure everybody was okay and that you liked me and that I wanted to make sure I opened up all these presents, you know, and did it right and showed my gratitude because I knew the story of our family and how hard it was for them to work all that year to get those presents. And I'll never forget one time I'd asked my dad if there were more presents so I could open them, and he got so offended as if I was ungrateful. And my brain said, well, you know what, I'll never ask another question as long as I live, you know. I don't like the answer I get, and I don't like, you know, getting my feelings hurt, so I'm never going to ask. And for me, that just kind of put the veil down between you and me a little bit more. And after that, it was just my life began where I just tried to figure it out on my own. I was always trying to figure out life, and I knew that I just decided you were different, and there was something not wrong with me, but just different about me, the way I saw the world, and never felt like I could fit in. And so early on, finding my friends, you know, that just typical running around town, and this was in Long Beach, and we would drink, and I drank just to fit in, you know. It wasn't anything special. It was just a little wine, a little weed, but God, you know, it seemed like after a couple of rounds of this bottle, I knew I just wanted the whole thing, you know. My friends became my enemies because I competed for alcohol. And I was only 11 years old, and back then you could run around, you know. I think a lot of us are old enough, you know, times were different. You could just kind of hang out in your neighborhood, and in Long Beach where I lived, you know, it was, you know, I was a home girl, you know. I wasn't in no gang or anything, but I had just grown up in the neighborhood long enough so I could kind of go between different territories. And all I wanted to do that night was just drink, and I ran up and hooked up with other people, and that night just turned into an adventure. You know, had I known that that was kind of my path of alcoholism, I might have just took a look at that and stopped and not wanted to get in trouble and not wanted to, you know, offend or hurt or get in trouble. But I just found it was like my magic answer, you know. Even though I was in Long Beach hanging out, and Long Beach, I have to say, it's not La Jolla, okay? I don't know what to say. I love Long Beach, but it's not La Jolla. And what I wanted out of that bottle was that magic life I would watch on TV. I wanted glamour. I wanted money and wealth and comfort. I thought if I had more money, I would be okay. And if I drank, it's going to make me feel like I'm alive and I can go and connect and find that adventure out there. And that's what I drank for. But I knew that first night, it was an adventure. It wasn't just an evening out. And I was lucky. I recognized that in myself, that I was with the right people and nobody was hurting me. You know, I wasn't in any trouble, but I knew I could get in trouble if I was with the wrong crowd. And for me, my drinking was just this constant, you know, always balancing and thinking about, you know, controlling my drinking. And I hated that. I never had a good time sipping. So what would happen for me in the beginning is I could kind of wind that spring inside of me and sip and drink and maintain and have a good time, sorta. And then I'd go home and wait till my parents went to bed and I'd stay up and drink. And they entertained enough where they had enough alcohol where I could kind of steal their alcohol and not get noticed too often. But the thing about not being able to drink like you want when you're young is I was always waiting for that next party. And all my friends, it wasn't like you were my friend because of who you were. It was because of what I could get from you. Yeah, it was kind of just, my world just changed. It wasn't really full anymore. It was kind of empty in that way. I'm sorry, I'm saying a lot. That's funny. Boy, if you have problems with people and judgment, become a speaker. You know. Anyway, I'm just kind of off tonight with my brother, but I'm going to get through this the best I can. Anyway, in Long Beach, I was like one of the little home girls, and that didn't work out too well because my sense of adventure didn't match theirs. And I found myself, you know, shooting off my mouth at the wrong times. I thought I would become really tough and be a good fighter, but I wasn't. I was kind of like a Labrador, you know, and I wasn't good at that. I wasn't good at being tough at that time. And so sometimes I'd go out and I'd get my butt kicked, and I'd go home and try to pull it in and be this good girl. My dad had a lot of expectations about what they wanted for us, and to be this good, studious girl and keep an aspirin between your knees and hold it, you know, that was her, you know, just be like that, you know, be a good girl. And I really wanted to be a good girl. I know, that sentence just said a lot of inventory right there. But this, you know, let's be honest. When you're powerless, you're powerless. And for me, I don't know what it's like to be a guy out there drinking, but when you're a young woman out there, you know, all bets are off. You know, I had a lot of these standards for myself of what a lady should be like, but whoever wrote that book about being a lady drinking wasn't a lady, and they weren't drinking, I can tell you, because there were just sudden left turns that would happen along the way, and I'd find myself wanting to have a good time, and I wasn't too interested in boys in that regard, but it seemed to be the thing you had to do to drink. And so, you know, I died and I died. You know, a little bit of my self-esteem would go out the window, and I'd get messed up, and I'd, in the beginning, brush it off, you know. And I think that kind of living, you really do grow up fast. You know, there was a little part of that young girl in me that would just, I'd nickel and dime away and tuck it down. You know, in my home, I definitely had alcoholism in my home. And what I want to say about that is it's not so much that my parents were drunks, it's that they grew up with alcoholics. And so the less that ism just transferred a generation. And I wanted to say that because the last thing they wanted is to have a kid who was an alcoholic. I think now that I'm a parent, I can understand that better. You know, they worked hard. They did everything perfect because they didn't want their kids to be like what they grew up with and that whole nightmare. But here I was, and I knew something was wrong with me and my drinking, and I hid it. And I would change my friends with no tomorrow, you know, and I luckily, being mixed, you know, I can fit in pretty much anywhere. I mean, I look Puerto Rican, I look black, you know, I don't look white, but, you know, I could work it, you know. And and I would just hang. And Long Beach is kind of like that. It's very welcoming. You can be whoever you got to be as long as you're cool, you know. And I would just go from group to group, and I would last for a couple of weeks, a month, and then, you know, I'd end up kissing the wrong boyfriend or drink your drink, you know, steal some money or whatever the deal was. I was always up for the challenge. I never questioned what the plan was. I was the executioner. I was good at making it happen. And drinking gave me that courage, and I never looked back, except when I would get sober. And then what would happen is I'd have to be this, you know, Chief Lewis's daughter and all those expectations. You know, I'd try to go to school, try to focus, try to be right. And all that the night before or what I did last week, I would start to think and I'd start to look at the kids at school and I'd see how young and innocent they were and they weren't like me. And I wish I could just be like them and I couldn't. And I felt like all that was out there for me was that way of this, you know, running around in the streets. And I tried to make that right with myself, but I never was okay with that. I always felt like I was better, you know, destined for something more. But after a while, there's a part of me that just turned off, you know, and it was for my own survival out there. I just shut down and I became hard-hearted, you know, and just like a little soldier in that regard. And, you know, and just kind of went into oblivion. There's really nothing exciting about that is when you're, you know, 12 and 13, trying to be 18 and hard-hearted and running the streets. I'm just grateful I didn't get into a gang. I think nobody wanted that hassle, you know, because I was just a mess. But I tried to do, you know, with junior high, and I would show up, and I just more and more I was showing up to school drunk, and I would go through, and the head counselors who would sit me down, they'd try to talk to me. I had people try to talk to me and scare me, you know. Scared straight I don't think was a big thing yet, but it was kind of like that. And one thing I can tell you is you can't scare the scared. You know, when you're scared, you're angry. That's the kind of person I am. And I could just be angry and just kind of, you know, lean back and just let them, give me your best shot. And I was unbreakable because I knew at the end of the day, somewhere I'm going to get that hustle on and I'm going to find what I need to feel well and make my armor a little tighter and it's going to be okay. And that was the obsession I had, is I always knew it was going to be different. Every time I drank, I knew I was going to meet the right people, get the right connections, and it'll be okay. And what happened is the summer of my 15th year, I was sent on a geographic. I think it was a family geographic because they didn't go anywhere, but they thought, and I thought, if I go to my dad's hometown for the summer and get God and get good, maybe that's going to change me. And in my heart, I really wanted it to. And what happened is after a month, I'd gotten saved twice in this small town. And there's nothing like the desperation of alcoholism, you know? It's like I was so willing, and I got saved, and I got saved twice because my family, you know, some of them didn't go to that church, so I went to both churches. And I remember feeling really good about that. And they at this time, I'd showed up to them all punk rocked out, and so they had to get the hair one color and kind of press back and dress me like a regular teenager. So my outsides looked good. I cleaned up really well, and I was doing the deal. And God, after about a month of that, I was minding my own business and at this corn festival. And it was really hot. And then I started drinking because it was so hot. I just wanted like this ice-cooled homebrew kind of wine cooler thing they had going. But it wasn't wine. It was something really good. And so I don't know what it was, but it was good. I had four of them, and I was feeling so good. I remember I fell in love with my cousin, and it was so humiliating looking back. But at the time, I fell in love with this guy, big old beefy guy, and I loved the way he held his bottle of beer. That's love, baby, because I knew this guy knew how to drink. I knew that he would not judge me, and we would have a good time, and he wouldn't be afraid of me, and he could handle me, you know, if I got out of tune. And so we set to drinking and talking and all that good stuff and promised me the world, you know. As soon as he got out of high school, he was going to come back to California and come get me and join the Navy, and we'll be wonderful, and we'll be great. And I was like all for it, you know, hook, line, and sinker. Except I couldn't stop drinking, you know, and those dreams are kind of like, you know, they kind of go and then they pass, and even that fell apart, and I made an absolute fool out of myself in this small town with my behavior, and I can't imagine the amount of embarrassment I was to my family, because it was a real small town, and as you know already, if you've been sober a while, you know, like, bad news travels faster than good news, you know, and this small town was no exception. And it was really humiliating because, one more time, I was trying to do the right thing and be good, and I failed. I just felt like such a failure at 15 years old, and I tried to kill myself, and it was, you know, again, I couldn't even do that. I had no courage to kill myself. And when I look back, I think there was that little flicker of hope, that insanity, like, maybe I'm going to, once you kill yourself, that's kind of it, you know. I didn't want to, I'm always like, I don't want to miss out on the deal, and I always thought, but you know, maybe if I get back to Long Beach, you know, and if I go across town, you know, I'll go over to my other friends over by Polly, and this and that, and it'll be different. But I don't know, it kind of was and it wasn't, and I had one more lecture. I had a lot of people in my family who wanted the best for me. And they didn't understand alcoholism. I remember I had an aunt. She would give me these lectures. I'll never forget the rattling of the ice. She loved Crown Royal, and so did I. And I was like, lady, you can say whatever you need to say. I'm just going to get some of that. All I was watching is where she was putting it. And it was just like that. I was in my mind was, you couldn't get to it. And but this was bad. And so I got sent home, and my poor father, you know, this man, I broke his spirit. I broke him, and I had wanted to, you know, I was kind of going for that because nobody's going to tell me what to do. And I had my long list of things that he should have done different. But there's something about the sound that your heart makes when it breaks, you know, when you hurt somebody really bad and their look changes. And you know, he had been to Vietnam. He had done a lot of things, and he had had his share of struggles with that. But this poor man, you know, he cried because he was so helpless. I know today, as a parent, you know, how that your child can drive you crazy and break your heart. And you want so much for them, but you just feel so powerless. And this was how he felt. And my answer to that was to my plan was to go with my best friend. We were going to go hit my other best friend's house. And then with the money, we were going to go get some Ashita acid and go to Toronto and sell it. And he had some gas station jobs lined up. I know, right? This was my plan, the answer for that. And I'm so glad I could. Sometimes my plans, I could not execute them anymore. And this one, for some reason, my mom decided to look under my bed and saw my suitcase. And we talked that night. And all I remember is telling her that I felt like I was in a funnel and I couldn't get out of it. I just felt like the harder I climbed, the more it was just a matter of time and I'm going to slide right back down into it. So what's the use? What's the point of trying, you know? I knew I needed to prepare myself to learn what it's like to really live out there on the streets. You know, I had always had a place to come home to, but I knew I could feel the tide was changing. And every time I'd go out there and run the streets, I felt the danger closer and closer, and I just knew my time was coming. I was going to get, something bad was going to happen. I had stopped praying, and it wasn't because I didn't believe in God, but I couldn't face the rejection of Him not being there. I just felt that bad and dirty inside. A couple days passed, and my mom invited me to go to treatment. She just said it was like a therapy group for teenagers to talk about their problems. And I'd been to therapists, and that didn't work because at some point they always ask, have you been drinking? And that was the end of the session. So this one, she said, well, this one, you know, this is a group. And I thought somehow if I was in the herd, I wouldn't get called out. And it was 3 months. And I thought, well, that's great because once time passes, I will, you know, my dad will forgive and forget. Somehow we always went back and forgave each other. And I know now that that's just that obsession that the family disease has. You know, we all want to think it's going to be different one more time. So anyway, I was thinking, what time do I stop? Is it almost
10 o'clock?
Shut up. That's the thing when you're local. Anyway, I'll just say what happened then is I went to this treatment place, and I thought I was going to Norwalk State Mental Institution, and I was okay with that. And I think for me, I guess, I don't want to forget that. I was that kid who was 15 years old. On the outside, I look like my daughter. And any of you, you've seen Camilla, she's been raised in AA. You see that cute little kid, and that's what I look like. I was a little girl, but inside I was just a rat's nest. And I was so done. I was so sick and tired of being sick and tired. I was so empty inside. And if the best I could do was go spend some time, you know, in Norwalk, that's okay. I was okay with that, and I could hang, and whatever they had, I was ready for it. But little did I know I was going to Doctors Hospital of Lakewood, which was a treatment facility for teenagers. It was like 4 months old. And all they knew pretty much to do was take us to AA. I'm sure they had group therapy, but I was not present, if you know what I mean, and keep us in school. And that's what I did. My sobriety started in this little treatment center. And I learned the basics about what alcoholism is and this disease. And I kind of just thought, well, okay, it's just a nice place to rest. But I really didn't know if I was an alcoholic or not. It wasn't until I started coming out to meetings. And there was something about hanging out when I started to see people, and they kind of seemed a little rough around the edges, but they had the soul that was so light and the light in their eyes. This was an attraction. Their stories told me that they knew what it was like to run and run around and be young and out there, you know, drinking and using and all the trouble. But their souls seemed to just be light and happy and clean from the inside out. And I wanted that for myself. And I just would lean in a little more and hear what you had to say. And you talked about your personality type as an alcoholic. And I identified. I knew I was overly sensitive. And I knew that somehow, sometimes my head would start going and nothing would shut it up but a drink. Just that relief, you know. And that the light in my soul only lit up when I drank that first mouthful of alcohol. I think that's what it was kind of throwing me off, is I was really thinking about my brother tonight. I understand why he drinks. I know what it's like if you got rent or whatever pressures in your life. That relief from alcohol tops everything. And I connected to that. And I think the hope that I got from these people was the joy in their life, the joy of living. That AA, the way they explained it, isn't about just not drinking. They said you can hit a cop and not drink. You know, you can do, you know, your deal goes wrong and you can do your time clean. You could do a lot of things and not drink. But they talked about the problems that happen after you don't drink. And that's what I understood, because that's the part of me that I never wanted to talk about out there, is how I felt bad inside and so afraid. And I could, as tough and rough as I thought I was, you know, I was scared to do anything nice or right because I didn't want you to make fun of me. Just like super sensitive and immature and all this kind of contradictions. And the obsession, they talked about this obsession with alcohol. And that was something I really needed to hear early on. Because I remember this one old guy, he talked about he could walk into the bar, I remember in Downey, and it was a mahogany wood, and he would just brush his fingers on the wood, and he would feel better because he knew, without looking up, the bartender was setting him up and knew his drink. And I know that feeling, because that's how I would feel when I'd turn the corner and I was going to my park with my friends, you know, and I knew, you know, it's 2:30, you know, after school, and I know I'm getting ready to get right, and it's going to be good. Or when I would turn the corner, and all of a sudden I'd see the headlights, and I knew those headlights, and I'm just going to turn a few corners and see what we're getting into and what's going to happen, and it's going to be good, whatever it is. All that obsession, and one more time it's going to be different, and how it would fall apart. I started to relate to you, and I felt like maybe there's a place for me in Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't know. The part that was scary for me was learning to live life on life's terms. And my life term was I was 15 years old in Alcoholics Anonymous, and they're saying that this is the last house on the block, and I don't know what the hell to do about that. The last thing I wanted to do was feel the feelings and face the fact that I felt like I had lost my childhood growing up. I felt like I had lost my innocence. And could I live sober and clean, knowing and living with the things that I had done as a young girl? You know, would I be able to feel like a lady in sobriety with dignity and grace? You know, my MO was never to be a trier. You know, I wanted to just point the finger and judge the lovely ladies in AA because I'm never going to be like them. I'm going to be one of the guys, you know. And just fear. That's just fear. Fear and hopelessness. And I couldn't think of a better place to be in Alcoholics Anonymous is coming with a lot of desperation, spite, fear, and anger. You know, we were talking about anger before the meeting. I had so much anger in me. I know today it was a lot of sadness. There was just a lot of soul sadness that was coming. But I was so angry, and I could go toe-to-toe with anybody in AA. And for a long time in AA, I had an edge about me. And at some point in my sobriety, I realized it's not going to go away. You know, if I have to wait for this anger to go away, I'm never going to get sober. And, okay. But I realized from the men and women in AA is it takes what it takes to stay. And if you have to stay sober and be mad, you can stay sober no matter what. And it's okay to be mad. And if you still show up and do your part in AA, it's gonna more will be revealed. And they shared their experiences of how that happened. Anyway, I better share some recovery for God's sakes. I'm sorry. I want to tell you the steps for me. My first 30 days, you know, no, it was maybe 90 days. I fought like a lot of new people. Once you're sober and clean, you're going to get a free pass on life. Nothing bad will ever happen. And that no matter what came to me very young. My parents divorced, and I found out I was pregnant. And I was, you know, not even 6 months sober. And I had a lot of decisions. I had every excuse in my book to turn and go out there because I had a lot of things to think about. And for me, it came right down to it. This program either works or it doesn't. And it was my opportunity to stay and to start to find myself in this program. And I started to use the big book as a map and start to read it until I could see myself. And I just did it because I felt I had no other options. And what that sprung out was this great journey in Alcoholics Anonymous. For me, sobriety is part, it is of God. It is the sunlight of the Spirit. And it seemed that the harder I leaned into it and tried, even if it was broken or fearful, every little step I took, there would be a hand there, some kind of message at the meeting, a person, an opportunity, an experience that kept me coming back. And little by little, I grew. And the thing that I'm grateful for with the 12 steps is I I am free from the bondage of self. You know, the old idea of who Diana was, you know, that hard-hearted little girl, no longer exists. You know, I've been so many women in Alcoholics Anonymous to be this one standing here, and that I have freedom from the past. You know, I took those steps, and I cleaned up my side of the street, and I embraced a loving God to the best of my ability. And I'm here to tell you, newcomer, it doesn't matter where you come from. It doesn't matter what you've done. If you are willing to take a little ounce of hope and put it in you, it's going to grow. And that's what happened, you know. I started out at Reed Continuation High School. And the old-timers told me, for me, getting back in the mainstream of life was going to school and just getting graduating. And I did that, and I was scared. I was so scared because I didn't have my attitude and my game. I just showed up and was just, you know, Diana, little co-ed. And I got involved with just all the things that the high school kids did. And by the time I graduated, I had this experience where, you know, a profound sense of hope happened in my sobriety around 3 years sober. And what it felt like was innocence. I'd gotten a sense of innocence, a new freedom, we talk about it, and a new happiness. And for me, it was that feeling that I could just be a teenager. I could have fun. I could live life. I didn't have to feel ashamed of who I was or what I did because it wasn't me anymore. I had a second chance to go out there. And I did that. For years in my life, I went to meetings, and I lived a full life. I have lived a full life without putting AA second. I moved up to L.A., and I needed to be with a big herd, kind of like this meeting. And I went to Pacific Group, and that was perfect. It was like a village, and I could go to these people and get life lessons in AA and learn how to live sober. And I did that for like 3 or 4 years. And then when I was 21, I left and I went overseas and I traveled in Europe and Denmark and had like a story, maybe AA, boy meets girl on AA campus, but I think it was more like the little fairy tale romance. You know, I fell in love with this Great Dane guy, and he had thought he had won the jackpot, you know, because they didn't have too many brown little beauties like back then. And he had thought he had lost his mind, man. He was so happy. And you know what was cool is because of taking the 12 steps, I really felt it was okay for him to feel that way about me. I didn't have to prove him wrong. And we stayed married and moved here to San Diego for 7.5 years. And you know, for his reasons I'll never understand because he's dead now, you know, he got thirsty. And he went out there, and I'm here to tell you, you know, over the next 13 years, I watched this man go in and out wanting this program back, and he couldn't get it back. And he died maybe 4 or 5 years ago, and that was sad. And I walked through that and you know, tried to be helpful to his family. But in my own life, I went out and I got a career, you know, and who knew? I mean, I knew I'd always been a chemist, but then I became a real chemist, a scientist, and that was exciting. You know, I started out at community college and just worked my ass off and ended up, you know, getting a bachelor's from UCSD in chemistry. And I had no idea I liked that stuff, and I love math. I mean, to me, when I would read chapter 4 and I looked at that fundamental idea of God, I right away thought about the science. You know, that's what my higher power was able to reach me with, and all of those principles, and being out in nature and the ocean. And I just took that out there, and I worked for 15 years in the science field, and I loved it. And along the way, Camilla is 15 now. So 15 years ago, I had a baby. And gosh, when I was pregnant that 9 months, I so wanted to have a baby. You know, I didn't want to get rid of this one. And I was so scared because I knew I'd be a terrible mother because I was just so wrong in my head and so selfish. But I really wanted it, and that was an opportunity of step 3 one more time where I really could turn my will and my life over to God and who I was as a person. And through taking these inventory and the 12 steps entirely on being a mother and being pregnant and all that, by the time she was born, I really felt as ready as I was going to be. And what came to me was that I'm a guide. You know, I'm not her sponsor, but I'm kind of like that. You know, I'm going to be her guide for the next, you know, 70 years, and I get to show her how we do it here, you know. And it's been that way, and to be that example. And it's really been a lesson of the bond, freedom from the bondage of self. She is, there's things that I do for her because of the principle of motherhood, and I can take away my personalities and my personal selfish wants. And it's a huge sacrifice. I'm not going to lie. Being a single mother has been one of the hardest things I've ever had to do in my life. And there's times I get tired, and I just don't know if I can do it anymore. And now she's 15. I'm in the home stretch, man. And I'm just like, wow. And I want to slack up, you know, because I think, oh, she knows how to do all the basic stuff. I can just run around and do my thing. And what I realize is this is the time you need to lean in more. And what I've learned is to practice AA in my home. I think if I could carry my little thing or my experience, strength, and hope that I feel helpful with others is practicing AA's principles in the home and learning how to be right and learning how to be wrong. And the thing with parenting and children is influence. I know that she is going to be who she is. She might take a drink and find magic like me. I don't know yet. But I know that I can live my life one day at a time, so to the best of my ability, I can influence her life. I'm going to try to limit my part in her inventory. That's my goal. And I can just be there, you know. I try to live my life so she knows AA is number one in my life, but she also knows that she doesn't have to raise herself. You know, I'm a present mother, and that's sacrifice. You know, I don't get to go to as many meetings as I want. Certainly haven't had to get out and have a lot of relationships or do things. You know, a lot of times I'm home crocheting with the cat, you know, because I know that she's upstairs doing her thing in her room, and I'm giving her such a peace of mind and joy knowing that her mom's downstairs crocheting with the cat. And it's that kind of, that principle of anonymity. It's what I do. It's not how I say it or who says it. It's just how I walk, you know. I really walk this talk. And that gives me so much strength. It's funny, just to end with this, is the thing about amends, you know. My amends over time, you know, it's through these actions and clearing up the wrong in my life, you know, the wrongs that I did. When I looked at that inventory, you know, and looking at my part, and I've done a lot of rounds with the steps, and what that just means is I'm willing to be teachable, and I learn every time. And I've learned at, I say the last couple years, I really saw my part in how I my self-righteousness with my family, you know. I had still had this feeling that of less than, that I was jealous or couldn't feel a part of my family, and I wanted so desperately to be a part of them, but I wasn't. And so instead, I kind of just self-righteously said, well, I don't need you. I need AA, you know. And I would kind of make that and throw that in their face, not intentionally, but this time I really saw that. And so my amends to make that right with them is to find ways to connect with them. And, of course, I don't stop doing AA, but what I do is I really try to take the time to spend with my mom and not try to fix it. And what I do is I would show up and spend a lot of money and act like everything's great. I'm big Diana in AA. And what I realized is I thought I was doing it for them, but I realized I was doing it for myself to cover up my own fear. And what I realized is these people all these years have never wanted anything but the best for me. And they didn't really need all those great times and great events and big Thanksgiving dinners, you know, because I'm a cook and I would make these big dinners on the holidays. This last year, my sponsor suggested that I just show up. And if we just spend time together. And if we have a big dinner, we do. If we don't, we don't. And what was so powerful is I got to see them in their life. You know, my mother is, she's dying of cancer. She's very sick. And she's got a great light of hope that she's going to be okay no matter what happens. And she lives with this every day. And then my brother, as I said earlier, you know, his liver, and he's got a lot of problems. But all these years, they've like showed up for me to be there at these Thanksgiving things and Christmas because they thought that it was something important for me. And it was very humbling to see this love, unconditional love my family has for me. And it gave me the right compass, because I know what I got to do in my life as a participant in the family is to just, I be there for them unconditionally. You know, I've learned to love them. In Al-Anon, they have a saying about detachment, without distance. And I feel that for us in AA, we say that's the principle of learning how to, you know, let go and let God, you know, where I can be around my family this holidays and be of service without any statement. I'm just showing up. I don't have to overdo or nothing. And it's really been a freedom. I'm very happy about that. Anyway, this is kind of weird, and I'm glad it's kind of over, and thank you for listening.